Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. Well, on today's program, on the menu tonight, as a topic goes, is risk reduction. So we'll begin with a little amuse-bouche about heat conditioning. After that, when is that abdominal pain at 2 in the morning ER material? After that, we'll highlight a dangerous chemical that's increasing in household use and what you can do to decrease your own risk, that of your household, and that of our shared environment. So are you planning a summer trip to a hot zone? Do you look at the 10-day forecast and have an OMG moment? I was planning a hike that day. Well, okay. Take some advice from England's football team, that's to say soccer, when they set up camp in West Palm Beach, Florida, about 2 weeks before the start of the 2026 World Cup. They're so used to the mild climate of Britain, they had experts helping them on to try to put it together. But how can you, if you're not an elite sports player with lots of experts, what can you do? Well, it's simple. And actually doesn't take that long. A little bit of advanced planning can make a real difference if you're heading for a hot zone this summer. Preparing for heat requires exposure to heat. When you expose yourself to heat, that causes your kidney to hang on to fluid, increasing levels of blood plasma. What that does is mean that the heart doesn't have to work as hard to pump blood, so it can beat in a more leisurely manner. Now, the simplest way to exercise, let me start with the best way, okay? The best way to bring about these changes is to do something called controlled hyperthermia. This is what the athletes got. Locked in a heat chamber for 90 minutes and monitored with a rectal thermometer. And in that sweltering heat, participants spent 30 minutes exercising to raise their core body temperature to a target value of 38.5 centigrade. That's a core temperature of above 103. The next hour is spent alternating between exercise and rest to keep their temperature fixed at that target. And then you repeat for 5 to 7 days, and then you go play in the World Cup. Well, few of us have the requisite apparatus for that, but you really can do something very simple. This comes from research published in 2016 in the Scandinavian Journal of Medicine and Science in Sports. And what they found is that 40 minutes on a treadmill in an 80-degree room, followed by 40 minutes in a hot bath daily for 6 days, was improved several measures of acclimatization and would probably help you avoid heat stroke. However, published in April, hot baths alone can do the trick. Another research project looked at healthy and aged, over 65, my people, showed that an hour a day in a 40-degree centigrade bath produced signs of acclimatization after just 4 days. So what you have to do, essentially, is get in a 40-degree centigrade bath. My hot tub goes up to 105. And after your body goes, oh my God, I'd better get some heat shock proteins going. And all sorts of DNA starts being manufactured to help you resist heat. Just immersing yourself in hot water brings about that necessary increase in core temperature that they were talking about. But it's not permanent. You have to keep exposing yourself to heat. But a few days of training help a lot when you're leading up to a heat wave. Evidence suggests that 75 to 80% of the necessary adaptations build up in the first 4 to 7 days. Now, this doesn't get you out of having to stay hydrated and make sure that you get enough electrolytes, but that persistent hot bath is one quick trick to help prevent you from heat stroking out on your visit to Pompeii. All right, let's go on to 5 signs that mean you should go to the ER. Now, I'm seeing a lot of pushback from my patients when I tell them that they need to go to the emergency room, and I'm sure you've heard stories about crowded emergency rooms and long waits, and yes, they're true. We've actually been kind of spoiled in Santa Cruz. We didn't have that problem or at least not every night, all the time, for many, many years. But we have it now. This is one of the COVID bonuses that we're all dealing with. Not to mention an aging and population and an increasing population without having increased emergency room capacity or, for that matter, bed space. So here are the 5 things that really should make you grab your Kindle or your tablet or a good long book and your earplugs and head for the emergency room. And the first one is, and we're talking belly pain or abdominal pain here, pain that feels worse when you cough or if you're in a car and you roll over a bump. Okay, that is a red flag. When I get a call about abdominal pain, cramping, and diarrhea in the middle of the night, it's the first thing I ask. All right, I want you to take a big deep breath and cough hard and let me know if that makes the pain worse. If it does, that's a sign of peritonitis, which means the lining of your abdominal cavity, not your gut superficial skin. That's the visceral peritoneum, but the lining of the inside of the cavity, the abdominal cave wall, if you will. When that's inflamed, it means, among other things, something's broken open. It could be an appendicitis if the pain is localized. If it becomes generalized, that appendix is probably ruptured. We'll talk about a few other things that it can be. Blood in the abdomen from something bleeding into the abdomen. Blood's very irritating, causes a lot of pain. And sometimes the abdomen wall will even get rigid. Here's another one. You've got abdominal pain, and it's pretty bad, and you haven't been having bowel movements or farting. Lack of farting is actually a red flag. And if it's accompanied by pain and you really may have a bowel obstruction, especially if you are nauseated. And if you can't keep food or liquid down or have no desire to swallow any liquid, that's a sign that your body is telling you that you have a blockage. And a bowel obstruction can be very serious. If you vomit and it's dark green, that means that your bile from your liver is actually going upwards, so into your mouth, and so that tells us a lot. Another thing to check with abdominal pain, particularly if it's been persistent but not too severe and it's been on the right side of your body, is check your whites of your eyes. And if the whites of your eyes are turning yellow, that's a visit to the emergency room. You could have an infection of the bile ducts. Those can be very serious and lead to sepsis. And a simple lab test that can be done in any emergency room will absolutely tell you that you don't have that, which is the answer that you want. You want the trip to the ER to have been unnecessary and a false alarm. You don't want the disease. Another one is, then these are lower levels of abdominal pain, not necessarily quite so severe that you know you've got to go to the ER, but it's been around for a while. If your stools turn black and sticky, and I mean black, we used to say black like tar, but the latest article I read said black like the color of your smartphone screen, black and shiny. And if that describes what you're seeing, you need to find that could be a bleeding ulcer. You're bleeding essentially into stomach acid, and the stomach acid is turning the blood black. If you have a stomach ulcer and you get nausea and vomit and the blood looks like coffee grounds, It won't be shiny. It'll be grainy. The shininess happens as it passes through the small intestine and gets digested further. But there is no other color of poop, even black, if it's not shiny and you've had iron pills or medications like Pepto-Bismol, artificial dyes like beets. There's no other really bad emergency color to your poop. Even anything short of magenta is probably okay. If you're seeing magenta, you probably are bleeding a lot. So yeah, that one I would get checked out. Dizziness and abdominal pain is an emergency until proved otherwise. It could be diverticular bleeding. It could be a peptic ulcer. Those generally hurt. But it could also be a leaking abdominal aortic aneurysm. And this can cause sudden severe pain. And often it'll zip down the down or up the back and even up and down the legs. But it has a zipper-like, very severe quality. That's this feeling of a blood vessel tearing. That is a 911 call. And while we're talking about this last one, ruptured abdominal aortic aneurysm, I have a message for particularly men, because men get this more often than women. But any man who has smoked more than 100 cigarettes over the course of their lifetime, which in the boomer category is most of them, because they usually bought, you know, a pack or two or five. Five packs, it's not that long, not much. And the cigarettes really weaken the aorta. And so it's sort of like an acid burn. It just keeps going and going, even if you stop smoking. You need to know that we have a simple, painless outpatient ultrasound to screen for an aneurysm. But only 4% of eligible men in the United States have been screened, despite the fact that Medicare covers this. We doctors are doing a bad job in finding and recommending this test, and I'm going to do my very best to put this on my checklist in my physical exam questionnaire that I have all of my patients fill out. So just the question, have you smoked more than 100 cigarettes in it? You know, in your life, because women too, if they have been smokers, probably should be screened for this same thing, although the risk is much worse in males. All right, so our next story is about a class of chemicals found in nearly half of all disinfectants and surface sanitizers. And I really want to emphasize surface sanitizers, as in glass and counter cleaners, and also those little towels that come in the white can with the flappy lid. Those almost all have quaternary ammonium compounds, QACs. They are the germ-killing agent in wipes, sprays, hand sanitizers, and their use soared during the pandemic. I still have some in my office that I use to clean up for my final blood cleanup. And I couldn't get the ones were cleared for humans, so I got the ones that are cleared for veterinary offices. And then after I use them, I go around after a few minutes. I go around and wipe it down with water to get rid of them, because they're definitely toxic. And I wear gloves while I'm using these cleaners, and you should as well if they contain quaternary ammonium substances. So I have here an abstract article from Environmental Science and Technology 2023, and it's a review article looking at QACs. And the reason they did it was, as they say, QAC use has accelerated in response to the COVID-19 pandemic, and the banning of 19 antimicrobials from several personal care products by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration in 2016. So essentially, after 2016, we had fewer options, and the QACs stepped in to fill the lack. But there are problems with QACs across the life cycle of their production, use, and disposal. Production, of course, you have the issue of the worker exposure. Use, the consumer exposure and disposal, what happens when these things get into the water table or into wastewater that goes to the ocean. There are some real issues with reproductive issues, hormone mimicking, dermal and respiratory effects. These compounds are extremely irritating. They can help trigger asthma. They can cause skin dermatitis and rashes. They penetrate the skin very well, so they get into your body fluids. And there they have an adverse effect on lipid homeostasis, meaning they break down cell membranes. And the quaternary compounds get into the mitochondria. When they're in the mitochondria, they actually have several mechanisms by which they interfere with oxidative phosphorylation, which is the major way that our bodies make energy. And so they have a real significant impact there. There are studies in animals that are quite disturbing. This is when you basically clean the inside of the mouse cage and don't with this stuff, and that's the amount of exposure. Now, mice, of course, are small, but they have seen difficulty with pregnancy, a shortening of the estrous cycle, so they're having a hormonal effect that's pretty profound. They've also seen smaller litter size and more malformed fetuses that die, that abort. So these are mammals, so this is a pretty serious issue. And even C. elegans, our standard worm, is affected by low levels of this stuff. So it's pretty much toxic to cells. The real issue that they cover in this article that I hadn't really thought about was the fact that we're getting exposed to mixtures of these things, multiple sources. So not only is the science, which is looking at individual groups, we don't really know if there's a multiplicative or synergistic effect with different groups of these compounds. And other places have restricted their use, but of course we are the land of the free. You know, that's our motto. And so the idea that we would hamper your ability to purchase whatever product the companies are willing to put on the shelves that isn't, you know, obviously harmful, you know, like your melt or something when you touch it. The standards are pretty low for some of the topical uses, particularly now that we're all cleaning off surfaces obsessively. Although I think that's gone down a bit. I'm a great fan of vinegar and water. Vinegar is, you know, it smells a little funky, but apple cider vinegar in water is, you know, smells better. It still smells acidy, but it's tolerable, and you get used to it, and it's a good cleaner, and it will kill bacteria, and it will kill mold, and it won't kill you. You can drink it. So that's what we want in a household cleaner. You can go to the Environmental Working Group site and get a list of products that don't have quaternary ammonium in it. That's EWG.org. I don't always love everything they do. Sometimes they're a little alarmist, but I think in the case of this, I checked the data, I checked the science, and there's good reason to be alarmist about this stuff and to seek to minimize our risky exposures. Our next story is about babies. Yeah, babies are so cute. And you want to see those little, you know, chubby cheeks and those little legs, you know, that they're just so soft and you want to squeeze them. They're like a living plushie. But we really have to watch the sugar that we give to children. And a new emerging risk that is being reported from a new study is you can be setting your child up for dementia 50 or 60 years from the time you're giving them the sugar. This came out of the United Kingdom Biobank records, and this is 65,000 people born in the 1940s and the 1950s. And comparing those who were raised during wartime rationing, at that time in England, they were being starved out. There was a war at sea. Sugar was hard to get, and they were limited to 8 ounces of sugar per person per week. the rationing continued until 1953. So we have World War II and then rolling in to the early 50s. Those exposed to less sugar because of rationing before the age of two had a 20% lower risk of dementia. And among those in the group that did develop dementia, the onset was 2.5 years later. Now, this protective effect, interestingly enough, held even for babies whose only low sugar exposure came in the womb. Now, this is a correlation study. It doesn't prove causation, but it adds to mounting evidence that the first 1,000 days of life can be critical for future health. Well, 1,000 plus 9 months, I would say. So early exposures influence dementia risk. We don't exactly know how or why. This needs to be investigated. We need to figure out ways that we can counteract it. But the obvious way to counteract it is don't use baby foods with added sugar. That's an easy one. There's all sorts of child-directed weaning stuff out there on the internet. When you want to satisfy or distract a child or get them to stop crying, go for something other than sweet. You're setting them up for a sweet tooth for life if you do that, and there's plenty of ways to distract a baby. Okay, our next one is about brain injuries in the Coast Guard. And this is a high school science project that may actually go on to change government policy. Riding in a rescue boat through crashing waves for hours probably is the same thing as football practice with helmets banging into helmets. Coast Guard rescuer Brett Bonner shot himself dead in early 2025. But this was after years of unexplained headaches and violent mood swings. He'd been in the Coast Guard as a rescuer. His teenage daughter, Kaylee, suspected a connection to his service as a surfman. That's what they call them. She mailed health questionnaires to other surfmen, and of the 77 who responded, most described the same torments as her father, headaches, memory lapses, anger. And these are the hallmarks of TBI, traumatic brain injury. We see the same thing in returning veterans who have been subject to IED explosions. Each time that 40,000-pound boat slams into a wave, a jolt rips up the spine to the skull, and the hit to the ship's deck is 6 times the force of gravity at the foot. By the time it gets to the sailor's head, it can be more violent than a car crash, 60 Gs, it's calculated. And that's happening over and over and over. Last week, this is from Argus, so literally this month, Kaylee's high school research was publicized, and the Coast Guard acknowledged for the first time that there was a problem with these injuries. Quoting Admiral Kevin Lundy in a speech to force members, "We owe it to you to protect your long-term health from the damage caused by relentless wave pounding." Now, how are we going to do that? Shock-absorbing shoes, that might do a little bit. I really don't understand the physics, and I don't have a suggestion for a solution, but I think one can be found, and I'm very happy that we have really started to take these traumatic brain injuries seriously. I was thinking I might save this one for Halloween, but I think it's so much more seasonal right now. It's a story about mosquitoes. And before I launch into this one, which is, after all, happening on the other side of the planet, although I will tie it together with what's happening on this side of the planet before I start, we are experiencing warmer climates. We are experiencing warming. That means that the ocean is changing. That means that the winters are getting warmer. And so we are, many insects that carry, quote-unquote, tropical diseases are migrating north. We're seeing dengue in the United States. We're seeing, so far, imported malaria, but it isn't such a far-fetched thing that we might, particularly in the swampy areas in southeastern United States, start seeing our own genuine homegrown malaria. This problem is also a problem of species changing throughout the planet. So a new genomic study has traced the alarming spread of a different kind of Anopheles mosquito, Anopheles stephensi. And this is a hardy mosquito that can carry malaria, but it's not native to Africa. It actually comes from South Asia, and it gained a foothold in Djibouti in Africa about 2012, and has since fanned out to Yemen, Ethiopia, Sudan, and Kenya. Now, this is a hardy malaria-carrying mosquito, and unlike the native species, this mosquito thrives in crowded cities, and it lives through dry seasons that once helped keep the disease in check. And doing DNA analysis, besides that march across the continent, the species has split into genetically distinct groups as it travels, but all of the varieties are largely immune to the anti-mosquito chemicals that are used in netting and sprays. Now, a child under 5 dies of malaria every minute. It is terribly hard on infants and children. We'll need to change our tactic in Africa and find something that these mosquitoes are sensitive to. And that type of research, I'll just for a moment say, that's exactly the type of research that has been defunded in this country because short-sighted people see no immediate benefit to themselves or their immediate family, their circle of, shall we say, caring. If you have a larger circle of caring, like minding that a child under 5 dies of malaria every minute, then you probably also want to think ecologically about the implications for that larger circle that you are a member of here. So malaria and dengue and other arthropod-borne diseases are actually really multiplying. The ticks, same problem with the ticks, although a lot of the tick issue, we have a lot more ticks, so we have a lot more vectors to spread Lyme disease and ehrlichiosis and babesiosis and a host of rather obscure conditions that infectious disease doctors know about, but the public doesn't really even think about. We actually need to consider culling the deer population. I know I've gone from mosquitoes to deer, but honestly, the more deer we have, the more deer ticks we'll have, the more deer ticks we'll have, the more vectors we have, and the more sick people. And of course, just like the malaria, that tends to strike the younger population who are out there, you know, running through the weeds and who we hesitate to dip in DEET because we're a little bit concerned about the implications of that. So moving on with risk reduction and how we're going to emphasize that in coming years, we have coronary artery risk reduction. And we're going to start with just figuring out how we calculate coronary artery risk. The main emphasis of this particular discussion is whether you should spring for a coronary calcium score. My patients are hearing about this. People are posting their coronary calcium scores online, if they're low at least. And I think that people are not understanding the utility of the test and maybe putting a little bit too much stock in it. And I want to also emphasize before I go any further, risk is not destiny. So there is a very good risk predictor called PREVENT. It's very science-based. And it relies on routine metrics, which if you've visited a doctor in the last 5 years, you probably know what your blood pressure is, and you probably know what your total cholesterol is. And I think your age and sex are probably things that you knew without visiting a doctor. And the PREVENT study, if you just type in PREVENT test, or the helpful search engine will take you right to the site, and you can plug in your own numbers. And you will get an estimate of your risk of having a heart event, like a heart attack, within the next 10 or 30 years. And if you're at high risk, you really don't need to do a coronary calcium score, because if you're at high risk already, a zero calcium score does not actually subtract any risk, because plaque doesn't always have calcium. So not having calcium doesn't mean that your arteries aren't jammed full of plaque if you have these other risk factors. And you know what? The biggest risk factors are age and sex. So when you do prevent tests on, say, a 65-year-old man, unless he has a cholesterol of like 170, he's going to come up as being considered to be at a higher risk of heart disease. But let's talk about where the calcium score is useful. And that's useful in people whose heart risk was classified as borderline or intermediate. And in that situation, you're generally dealing with a younger person. And in that circumstance, it can make the difference. When you look at the PREVENT score, just across the board, it only improved the forecast like a 2/100. That wasn't really particularly impressive. When you had an intermediate risk, and that risk would be if it tells you that you have a 3-9% risk of heart disease within 10 years, that's 3-9% a pretty broad range. So you look at that and go, okay, that means a 1 out of 30 chance. I think I'm going to just live with that. I'm not going to take a statin. I'm not going to change my diet. But if you put the calcium score in, and that calcium score is greater than your age normal in particular, then you really should reconsider not treating it. So if the risk is lower, a calcium score of 0 does help you say, well, that's lower, but the older you are, the less value a calcium score has. I think that's really the take home. It's not covered by most insurance, so you're going out of pocket for something. And if you're a senior, $150 for a calcium score versus a gym membership might be something to consider, as, you know, maybe the other purchase would be better. Now, our next risk reduction story is about dementia. And I want to take you back to last year when I originally reviewed a study that was published last year, but it was actually looking at a group that began in 2013. And this study came from Wales, but it subsequently, people looked at that and went, huh, I wonder if that's a fluke, or if other groups will also show the same thing. And it has to do with the introduction in shingles vaccine. Shingles vaccines were in England, in Wales, were offered in phases. And they did that by looking at the person's birthday and setting a date. It was an age-targeted rollout. And if you turned 70 on or just after the 1st of September, you were offered the vaccine. But if you turned 70 just before the cutoff, then you were deemed ineligible. And that's the sort of national health decision that you see in England. The older you are, the less services you get, because society doesn't really think that they get as much return on investment in keeping older people alive. So they just don't. It's hard to get a kidney transplant if you're 75 years old in England, unless you want to go private. And yes, probably people who are 75 don't live as long after their kidney transplant, so you could argue you're wasting a kidney. We don't make that argument here. Anyway, getting back to the shingles vaccine, they had a natural experience. But you had people who were essentially the same age, and statistically at least, they were randomized. Their diet, their lifestyle, probably the same in the people born before or after September 1st. And so they had two groups with one really significant difference. It allows you to make unbiased health comparisons between the two groups. If I take 1,000 people born 1 week and then 1,000 people born a week later, why should there be any difference on average in those people's diets or physical activities levels? And indeed, it's just like tossing a coin. And here's the payoff. In 2025, Gelsinger and other researchers sifted through the data, and what they found was people offered a vaccine were 20% less likely to develop dementia. Now, that's a big number, 20%. And a follow-up study even found that the vaccine could slow the progression of dementia in people who already had it. So just delaying the onset of Alzheimer's just a few months on a population level is a huge savings for the society. And the vaccine itself, of course, prevents shingles, or at least reduces the risk of the really, really awful postherpetic neuralgia, which is a chronic nerve pain that can last for years, that shingles can leave people. So other studies have looked at this. Other areas have essentially shown that this isn't just a fluke of the Welsh. Other vaccine rollout programs have shown similar decreases. So methodologically, different studies, but still a solid trend. Let's go way, way back. In the 1990s, British researchers discovered the DNA of herpes virus in the brain cells of elderly people that had, and of course, that's the virus that causes oral herpes cold sores. But later, just looking at brains that had been donated, they found that the virus was much more likely to appear in the brains of Alzheimer's patients than people within the disease. And the link didn't end there. Studies in multiple countries showed that people with severe herpes were more likely to develop Alzheimer's, and that herpes patients treated with strong antivirals showed a dramatically lower risk of developing Alzheimer's in later life. I read that data and came across the recommendation in a book called The Disease Delusion, written by one of my mentors, Jeff Bland. And in that book, he recommended just taking acyclovir as a preventative for dementia. And that's really pretty much the same thing that's happening with this, with the Shingrix. And it's been replicated in Canada, Australia, England, Scotland. And there was a new study that came out of researchers at Hebrew University of Jerusalem, which is new. It's been presented, but it looked at the Shingrix shot and basically found that if you gave that shot 4 weeks apart, which I do not recommend, and I'd want to see what their control group did, and I have not read the paper because it's not published yet, that it maintained a stable level of cognition in people who already had Alzheimer's. So it stabilized them. The unvaccinated patients continued to decline. So that's almost a therapeutic intervention at that time. And it kind of makes sense. Herpes virus lives in the nerves. Shingles lives in the nerves. It's going to cause low-grade neuroinflammation, and we know that's probably the causal factor for Parkinson's disease and Alzheimer's disease. BCG vaccine, which is a tuberculosis vaccine not used in the United States, also lowers the risk of developing Alzheimer's. That's used only here for cancer patients because it helps with the bladder cancer. And one study looked at, you know, the reduction, and they found a 400% reduction in dementia in bladder cancer patients who got BCG as part of their treatment. The more flu vaccines you have, the less likely you are to develop dementia. And literally, a high-dose flu vaccine might work a little bit better, although I'd want to see the data on that because there's some downside. So how can just these random vaccines that aren't necessarily neurotropic viruses, pertussis, for example, doesn't get into the brain, doesn't cause brain inflammation. And what very, very recent research has shown is that when we give these vaccines and we cause inflammation to occur, by giving these vaccines on a regular basis, we turn up the regulatory cells. So inflammation is something the body wants for a short period of time, and then it wants to shut it down. Well, if you have inflammation cropping up frequently, you develop more of the cells that shut down inflammation. And these cells get into the brain and apparently are working to shut down neuroinflammation. So the way people think about Alzheimer's now, what's really going on is that you get the brain inflammation from myriad different sources. You get it from having high insulin levels. That's good. You get it from having diabetes. You get it from exposure to toxins. Anything that causes inflammation in the brain increases the risk of dementia, just across the board. It does that because it activates the microglial cells, which are normally support cells. But once there is inflammation, once there are signals of inflammation, they actually can trigger cell death. So it's along the way, the inflammation interferes with the cleaning crew that goes through the brain and cleans up the beta amyloid and the tau protein. Now, these proteins are accumulating as the normal part of cellular renewal, but you have to clean, you have to take out the garbage. The brain of an Alzheimer's patient is effectively a hoarder brain. It's holding on to garbage that shouldn't be left there, and the garbage is essentially crowding the hallways and clogging the synapses and leading the microglia to declare the whole thing just a mess and burn it down. So this work is extremely promising, and the fact that there's like two pluses, right? You get not only the protection from dementia, but you also get a protection from a disease. I mean, influenza kills tens of thousands of people in the United States every year. It is the proximate cause of death because the heart can't handle the extra stress of the pneumonia that happens as a result of the flu. And post-flu pneumonias are very severe and put a terrible strain on the cardiovascular system. And we're off to the races, right? We get people dying of the flu. RSV, same thing. So it makes sense that giving these vaccinations and doing it in a careful, thoughtful way, not just slamming, you know, four or five vaccines into an older person. I'm totally against that because I just don't think we process the things that are along for the ride. There aren't many preservatives, but there are adjuvants, which are irritants. And I just think if you're older, you don't do that. You don't get rid of those that easily. And you don't want to throw more than one into your system at once, unless you live on an island and can only take the ferry boat out twice a year, and then you have to go to the pharmacy and get all your shots, something like that. All right, but for most of us, we're going to the pharmacy more than once a month anyway, so why not just spread those vaccines out, but get them. Just to celebrate a little bit, a oral medication that attacks KRAS, a gene that regulates cancer cell growth that is present in many cancers, but particularly dominant in pancreatic cancer. But this isn't just liver cancers, colorectal cancers. KRAS is a bad actor, and we now have a drug that suppresses it, that's an oral medication, and it suppresses it by inhibiting the proteins that KRAS makes. So it's a blocker, and blockers are generally the first thing that we manage to develop, but they are also almost uniformly pretty darn good. So this drug doubled survival in people with metastatic pancreatic cancer. Once you're described as metastatic and you have a very, very short lifespan, 6 months, maybe 7 is kind of what we expect. This was 500 adults with metastatic pancreatic cancer. They took the drug Diroxon-Racib, and they had a median survival period of 13.2 months. Now, that's not chicken feed. 6 months versus 13 months, I think I know which one I'd pick. So it's a big step forward, and I'm hoping that there will be many more drugs attacking KRAS now that they have figured out a strategy. And the more diseases that this is needful for, the more demand there is, that means the more capacity, that means the more production, and that means a lower price. So all things equal, I think that's a good place to end this program about risk reduction, and I hope you've found it to be a bit of a celebration of medical science. I know that I feel pretty proud of our scientists.
Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.